Is it a boy or a girl? Is usually one of the first questions out of a new parent's mouth. But what happens when the answer is, we're not quite sure? A whole range of medical conditions fall under the term intersex, a diagnosis where a child's sex is genetically or sometimes physically ambiguous. In some cases of intersex conditions, also known as disorders of sexual development or DSD, doctors and parents choose to perform operations that intend to assign the child a sex. But how does being diagnosed with this very sensitive type of condition, or undergoing surgery, affect intersex individuals and their families? To learn more about this incredibly complex topic, I spoke with Lansing-based intersex advocate Alice Drager. She's also a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Joining us over the phone was Dr. Arlene Barretts, a Pittsburgh radiologist who is a parent leader and board member of the AIS-DSD support group for intersex women and their families. I first asked Alice Drager to walk us through what types of conditions fall under the umbrella of intersex.
There's a lot of different conditions, so some of them involve genetic anomalies in terms of sex chromosomes. So most of us are born with either XX or XY, but some people can be born with those combinations of those types, or they can be born with XXY or 1X and no second chromosome. We can also find conditions which involve when a child is born having sex anatomy that's unclear, so that would be in the genital region. And then there can also be various kinds of conditions where somebody appears to be one sex on the outside, but internally they have some of the organs of the other sex.
And at what point of life are DSDs typically diagnosed?
They're diagnosed across the lifespan. So in some cases, even before birth, a fetus can be diagnosed as having a DSD, either through a sonogram or through a genetic screening test. It can also happen at birth. It can happen at teenagehood, at puberty. It can happen later in life when you are having problems with fertility and you go to a fertility specialist. And it even sometimes happens in 80-year-old people who die from old age and somebody discovers it in an autopsy.
How common are they?
How common it is depends on what you're going to count in the categories of standard male or standard female. Because when we're talking about intersex, we're talking about anybody who counts in between. So you have to decide what counts as standard male or standard female. And to do that, you have to decide, what are you going to count as standard in terms of genitals? What are you going to count as standard in terms of chromosomes? But if we put all the different kinds of anomalies together, it comes out to about 1 in 100 people have some kind of variation of the standard male or the standard female type.
Just to help us get a sense of how often DSDs occur, are there any other congenital conditions that are more widely known but less prevalent than DSDs?
Sure. Lots of things like Down syndrome is less common but more widely known. Various kinds of variations in nose types or ear types that may be relatively unusual, but you'll notice them. So, for example, being born with very large ears, people know about that, but it tends not to be that common in the population. The reason we're unaware that sex anomalies happen is because our society tends to be organized into a two-sex category, so everybody just kind of blends in. But once you start looking biologically, then you realize sex is actually really complicated, and humans vary a lot more than we've recognized until recently.
Arlene, I understand that you have two daughters who were diagnosed with androgen insensitivity syndrome. Briefly, what is that?
Androgen insensitivity syndrome, or AIS, is a condition in which children are born female and they happen to have XY chromosomes and testes. And during fetal development, their testes make male hormones or androgens, but their bodies are completely immune or insensitive to those male hormones, so they develop as female.
What was it like for you and your family to find out about this condition?
Well, at the time, I'm a physician, and I had been taught in medical school that intersex or DSD conditions were something just horrifying that patients could never know about. So if we were physicians and we were treating these patients, we'd have to do something to change them, and then it was imperative that they never find out about their condition or they might commit suicide. So for me as a young mom to find out about that was really devastating.
Were there places you could seek out help or advice about caring for your children?
I had really excellent medical care in Pittsburgh and physicians who were very progressive, but in terms of the kind of help that I really wanted, meeting other parents or meeting other people living with those conditions, it was not available.
How old are your children, and how has this evolved over their lives?
Over their lives, it's very interesting. When they were diagnosed, there was an older paradigm of treating children with the secrecy and not telling them about their condition. By the time they were in their mid-teens, I had found a support group which really advocated for telling the truth and being honest. So my family and I did that. And now they're both in their late 20s. My older daughter, Katie, is a physician herself, training in psychiatry, wants to be a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And actually, it's ended up being one of the best things in our lives because we've met all kinds of people, had interesting relationships. Katie and I have had a chance to be public advocates. It really hasn't hindered them in anything. They're happy and healthy in relationships. I couldn't be happier for them.
Our guests are Arlene Barretts, Pittsburgh radiologist and parent leader at the AISDSD support group. We're talking about intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Our other guest is Alice Drager, professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Alice, as you discussed earlier, types of DSDs vary, and so do, I imagine, options for parents and individuals about what to do with this condition. What are some of the various options?
It really depends on the condition we're talking about. So some of the conditions actually have medical problems that go along with them. AIS is not one of the ones that has an active medical problem, but women with AIS who have not had their testes removed have a slightly increased risk of testicular cancer. So they have to be monitored for that or have their testes taken out. There's one condition that makes intersex genitals in girls fairly common, and that's a condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH. And that's a condition where you have an endocrine defect. And the problem with that is, regardless of the intersex part of it, if the child doesn't get diagnosed with CAH, the child can go into adrenal crisis and actually get quite sick or even die. So now in this country, we actually have screening in all 50 states for children to be all screened for CAH because it's a serious endocrine problem. So part of what we're talking about is some of these conditions have underlying medical issues, and those have to be dealt with. But when you get into the question of the optional medical issues, a lot of times some physicians, especially surgeons, advocate for trying to make everybody look sexually typical. And so they'll try to introduce the topic of genital surgery for children for what is essentially a cosmetic reason. And that's quite controversial.
And how common is that?
How common is surgeons recommending it?
Yeah, for that very reason you just explained.
Well, surgeons have as their chief tool surgery. So they tend to offer it and even to recommend it. But what we're trying to do, what people like Arlene are trying to do, is to push very hard to make sure that mental health is the group that leads in these situations. So that what we have is a much calmer approach that deals with the stress, deals with the confusion, deals with the anxiety, and really approaches it as something where we address familial resilience, so the strengths of the family, the ability of the family to bond and to love, and really try to go in that direction before any questions about unnecessary medical interventions come up.
What possible effects can these types of surgeries have on children?
They can be quite devastating. So in some cases, there's no problems that come from them. But in some cases, people are left with scarring from the surgery, with incontinence from the surgery, with loss of sexual sensation or sexual pain. And those are often addressed with additional surgeries and additional surgeries. So there's people I know who have had dozens of surgeries all to try to correct the mistakes or the problems that came from the first surgery. So these are not without risk. And I think Arlene and I are on the same page in terms of really trying to support the idea that you should let children have their bodies intact, if at all possible, so that they can decide what to do with them, unless there's a dire medical emergency.
Arlene, tell us more there. Walk us through what this situation looks like from the parents' point of view. When a doctor believes surgery is required, are other options presented to parents?
They may be presented, but not in a way that makes them very appealing to parents. Often the choice is presented as surgery or nothing. And the other option to surgery is psychosocial support. As Alice mentioned, we're really interested in having behavioral health people support families. Having other families support them is very important. What parents really need is to be reassured that their child is beautiful and perfect, that they can love that child, and that their child is going to be happy and successful. If they're going to be thinking about surgery, they need to be presented honestly with the information about the kinds of complications that Alice mentioned. And they also need to know that sometimes this surgery is done on children in whom the surgery functions to reinforce a gender that is assigned to them. And sometimes those children don't feel inside like that gender when they get older, and parents are often not informed of that.
So sometimes it does result in a, quote, incorrect, unquote, gender assignment?
That's right. And there's nothing wrong with physicians and parents doing that at birth. You're taking a shot at predicting how that child will feel as an adult, and you don't always get it right. So there's nothing wrong with that, because that is something that can change. We have parents whose families have undergone a gender transition with their children, and it's been fine with support. What is a problem is when the wrong gender assignment is made and reinforced with irreversible surgery, and then you have a child who's had a catastrophic procedure, and that's not a good outcome.
How often is this psychosocial support offered?
That's a good question. There are centers in the country that are supposed to be centers of excellence. They are centers of excellence, and they offer psychosocial support to some extent. Realistically, how often it's easily available is another question. There are problems getting funding for psychologists, social workers, and other types of support people. And so realistically, parents don't always have access to those services. In terms of other kinds of support, like referring to a support group, some places are very good at doing that, other places not so good, so it really varies.
What we're really trying to focus very much on, Mark, and Arlene's been very active with the group Accord Alliance, who I've helped as well. Accord Alliance is the main group nationally trying to push for these Centers for Excellence to have psychosocial care. What we're really trying to get people to is the understanding that what we care about is health, not normality. And so what we really want to do is reach the point where these children's health is our center concern, and not whether or not they look exactly like every other boy or every other girl. And in that, we can try to play to the strengths of the families, because many families are actually healthy families with resiliency, and they can be helped to understand how it's possible to raise a child who's healthy and maybe a little atypical, but that's not that big a deal, that we're all different in some kind of way. This may be a more stressful one, but we can deal with that stress.
In your opinion, are physicians doing their due diligence to make sure that parents are fully informed of all the risks of associated with these procedures?
Some physicians are, but some of them, I think, feel that there really is no other way to care for a child other than to offer them normality. And the reason they're doing that is not because they're bad people, but because they're good people. They see themselves as having the best interests of the child in mind, and they're convinced that in order to have a successful life, you have to have a body that looks like other people's bodies. But what we try to do is encourage them to understand that the data's not there to support that point of view, that we know lots of people who grew up with sex atypicality, different kinds of sex types, who actually did well because their parents loved them, their parents were helped in terms of taking care of them, their parents were really focused on their overall well-being, not on whether or not they looked like everybody else. But a lot of surgeons, I think, feel that it's quick and easy from their point of view. It's not too often that something goes wrong, so why not go ahead and take a shot at it?
Alice Drager is our guest, professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. We are joined by Arlene Barretts, a parent leader at the AISDSD support group, about intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Arlene, what are some of the long-term effects of these surgeries on the family life of an intersex individual?
Well, as they affect the individual, they affect the family. So if a child has surgery that the child later on doesn't wish he or she has not had, there's a lot of unhappiness there, and children can blame their parents for putting them through that. They may not understand that their parents did it out of love, out of a desire to protect them, and that their physicians thought it was the best thing, but there can be a lot of anger there. It also sometimes impairs those adults from having relationships when they have issues with their bodies, when they have issues with their sexual function. It's hard for them to have relationships, and that's very painful for parents to have raised a child and have that child not be able to be in a loving relationship. So definitely can affect families.
Through your work, Arlene, have you seen a difference in the family lives of parents who have chosen to delay or opt out of surgery as opposed to those who decide to operate?
I do. We have lots of families, actually, who are raising their children openly, just letting them have their difference and live with it, and they're doing very fine. They're very healthy. There are actually families who choose to adopt children with genital difference. There's a whole group of parents who've adopted children internationally and are raising them to be healthy people. I think that the tone is really set by the parents and the family, and if parents can get off on the right foot with their medical care and with psychosocial support, then they can feel confident and do a good job raising these children to be healthy adults.
Given all the various potential outcomes involved here, it would seem that there's a lot of potential for guilt on the part of the parents here. Arlene, can you tell us more about how this played out in your family?
In my family, I certainly did feel quite guilty because I was the person who had transmitted this genetic condition to my daughters. When you have children, you know that it's two children, you know that it's in your family, in your own genes. I felt guilty about that. I felt very guilty and stressed that I would do something wrong that would prevent them from being happy later on. I wasn't sure how and when to give them information. That was very difficult. If I had had the support all along and just had people giving me ideas for parenting or reinforcing that things that I was doing were going to be okay, a lot of that could have been avoided.
And how has this played out in families who chose to pursue surgery?
Some of those families have joined our support group, and they do have regret about having made those decisions. And we know actually from some recent medical studies that about half of parents regret making a decision even to have the most simple of genital cosmetic surgeries. So it's not that surprising. They do have to accept that they made the best decision at the time with the information that was given to them. You know, lots of times they've been in these situations where they heard limited information before they consented to a procedure. And whether you've made a decision for surgery or not to have surgery, the most important thing is just to love your child and be open about things and let your child know that you'll always be there for them.
So in both of your opinions, these procedures are unethical when the child cannot participate in the decision, Alice?
I think it's fair to say that we don't allow parents to make whatever decision they want to make about children's bodies in other realms when a child is healthy. So, for example, say a parent wanted to come in and give a child an adult type of vaccine at an adult level of vaccination or an adult medication, we would say, no, you can't do that. That's not really something that this child needs. It's not something that we know to be safe and know to be effective. So I think this is one of those circumstances where what we can say now from what we know, we don't know it to be necessary. We know that it may be unnecessary. We know that there's a lot of issues with safety, and we know that it's not particularly effective based on the outcome systems in terms of telling us that these children are better off with surgery than without. What I would say is, in general, it shouldn't be offered. That in general, what should happen is the parents should be referred to these good teams, and what should happen is the mental health professional should lead and help parents deal with the anxiety and the stress and the confusion and the joy and the hope and the love that they're feeling, and really deal with that and deal with the issue that really is the issue, which is in many cases parental stress.
Arlene Barrett, anything to add to that?
I agree with Alice. Parents will often ask for this. They just think right off the bat that this can be fixed. I think they need to know that it can't be fixed, that they can't fix their own feelings, that they can't fix their children's bodies and make them be happy people by changing their bodies.
And what needs to change to make this decision or non-decision better for everyone involved, Alice?
I think the primary thing that needs to change is people need to change how they think about this. They need to stop thinking about abnormality meaning unhealth and start thinking very clearly about what health is as opposed to what something unusual is. And once we get there, then I think we'll have a system where we stop referring people to surgeons simply because somebody has a difference, as opposed to somebody has something that's genuinely unhealthy. We'll start to sort out with these conditions, is there an underlying health concern? And some of them there are. And in that case, we deal with the underlying health concern. But we have to sort it out and figure out that the things that are not health concerns but are really social concerns should be dealt with socially by having the rest of us grow up now for the sake of the children.
Is there anything you'd care to add to that, Arlene?
I think society needs to change. I think that clinicians, physicians need to change their attitudes as well and understand that parents are capable of doing this. They don't always seem to be able to absorb that. I think they have to make it their business to get involved with support groups. The more clinicians are involved with us, the better information the support groups are able to give to the families who join them, and the more clinicians will understand what actually goes on in those support groups and that there are plenty of healthy families out there who are living with these conditions with minimal interventions.
I think Arlene makes a really good point, and that's that physicians often underestimate the ability of parents to grow. And one of the things that we see is that parents in these circumstances at the beginning often think they can't handle it, but that's true with a lot of things with parenting, and people do learn how to deal with things. I mean, I've met parents who, when their first child turned out to be a child with a DSD, that was a disaster because they'd never been a parent before. But when I meet parents whose 7th or 8th or 10th or in one case 12th child turned out to be the child with DSD, they said, oh, kids throw stuff at you and you learn to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And their attitude was, this is one of those things the world throws at you. And as a parent, you got to learn how to take everything and cope with it.
We want to thank our two guests for an interesting and important discussion. Alice Drager is professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Arlene Barretts joined us from Pittsburgh. She's a radiologist and a parent leader in the AISDSD support group. Our topic has been intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.